Yet no conclusions are drawn from these data. On the contrary, the old, unsubstantiated theories are buttressed with new excuses. Excuses? A harsh criticism, one might think. In fact, it is almost too kind a term for the nonsense we are supposed to believe. How to discredit a decent person. The Egyptologists at the German Archaeological Institute are trying to get rid of Rudolf Gantenbrink. Why? Didn't his robot produce a monumental discovery? Did he not invest much time and over $300,000 to help archaeology gain new insights? Were his methods suspect? Not at all. Gantenbrink's work is perfect, his results readily repeatable. Was he impolite? Unfriendly? In no way. Gantenbrink is a very pleasant sort of person. Did he promulgate unspecific speculations? Again, the answer is no. Rudolf Gantenbrink was very reserved in his assessments in front of the media. As the project leader of the Upuout mission in the Great Pyramid, he steadfastly maintained that no one could know if there really was anything behind the newly discovered door blocking the tunnel. In no way did Gantenbrink enter into any kind of speculation about the shaft or the door. So where in the world did he go wrong? Why are the Egyptologists of the German Archaeological Institute trying to get rid of him? He talked to the media. Not that he in any way pursued journalists to publicize his discovery. It was the other way around. The journalists were hounding Gantenbrink after British scientists had gotten wind of his phenomenal discovery. It is a journalist's job and duty to sniff out interesting news and to investigate it. Rudolf Gantenbrink's reaction was objective, reserved, and decent. Was he supposed to lie to the media, put them off? Gantenbrink is not a politician. In an interesting article propagated by the German press agency DPA, George Fischer, a journalist, wrote on June 27, 1994, "As they have done in the past, the gigantic pyramids of Giza have again generated mysterious and mystical fantasies. The debate was triggered 1 year ago. Rudolf Gantenbrink, a robotics expert from Munich, arbitrarily took it upon himself to inform the media of the discovery, speculating that the door was hiding a burial vault. The director of the German Archaeological Institute, Professor Rainer Stadelmann, recollecting all the nonsense that has been written about this, points out that a German tabloid has already discovered the ashes of the pharaoh and a gold treasure inside the chamber. In this way, Gantenbrink is discredited by people who should and do know better. Gantenbrink never speculated that the door was hiding a burial vault. Members of the media who don't know any better are expected to believe the professors, are manipulated to discredit a person and to diminish his accomplishments. Gantenbrink did not arbitrarily release information to the press. At no time was he employed by the German Archaeological Institute or subject to any kind of gag order. The DPA article, which was disseminated worldwide and printed by many newspapers, was intended to spread false information. People were supposed to think that Gantenbrink had published unscientific suppositions. The article went on to say that this, in turn, aggravated the Egyptian government so much that it barred any further investigation of the pyramid shafts. What an outrageous distortion of the facts. Errant experts. The purpose of the DPA article becomes clear in a later passage. The archaeologist Professor Stadelmann categorically denies the possibility that another chamber may exist. After examining the pictures recorded by the remote-controlled video camera and comparing them to the other three shafts in the pyramid, he is convinced that the shaft is a modeled corridor. According to the religious beliefs of ancient Egyptians, the opening, which rises upward from the queen's chamber, was intended to allow passage for the pharaoh's soul to ascend to heaven. Stadelman believes that the black dust in front of the large rock is residue from the eroded metal brackets on the door of the model corridor. However, his prosaic theory and his repeated admonition that no human being could have crawled through the narrow shaft or used it to transport a sarcophagus or treasure are largely ignored. Those who do not believe this theory or refuse to accept it for other reasons must be crazy. I can't imagine why this learned expert categorically denies the possibility that another chamber may exist. After all, he is the one who invented the three-chamber theory. It has no room for the existence of a fourth or fifth chamber. It is quite odd. The rooms known to exist inside the pyramid at this point have a combined volume of approximately 2,000 cubic meters. This includes the three chambers, their access tunnels, and the Grand Gallery. The Grand Gallery alone, however, accounts for 1,800 of the total 2,000 cubic meters. In other words, the volume of the Grand Gallery far exceeds the volume of all three chambers combined, yet it is not considered a fourth chamber. Such an interpretation would not fit the sacred three-chamber theory. Moreover, the Gottenbrink shaft is supposed to be a model corridor, because ancient Egyptians believed that the pharaoh's soul ascended to heaven. Let us ponder this view of a model corridor for a minute. The ancient Egyptians erected the most perfect structure in the history of mankind. It consists of approximately 2.5 million blocks. The amount of pre-planning required must have been phenomenal. Each and every stone, every support bracket, was precisely fitted, built for eternity. Inside the pyramid, the Grand Gallery was constructed. The beams and stone slabs are so perfectly honed that it is difficult to see any cracks or joints. In order to get to the Grand Gallery, however, one must crawl through the so-called ascending corridor, bent over duck-style. No one knows why the builder of the Great Pyramid constructed such a low corridor to lead to the Grand Gallery. Yet Professor Stadelman knows beyond the shadow of a doubt that the Gottenbrink shaft is a model corridor, because he compared it with the other three shafts in the pyramid. Holy Osiris! What other model corridors are there in the Great Pyramid that could be used for comparison? Up to this point, the other shafts were called air shafts. Next, Stadelman claims that the Gottenbrink shaft is too small for a sarcophagus or even a treasure to fit through. How then does he explain the fact that the King's Chamber contains a granite sarcophagus whose dimensions exceed those of the ascending corridor? If we follow Professor Stadelman's logic, this sarcophagus cannot possibly be inside the King's Chamber, because the corridor, like Gottenbrink's shaft, is too small to transport a sarcophagus or treasure through. According to Stadelman, the builders of ancient Egypt constructed a model corridor inside this marvelous monument, which has survived so many centuries. But this corridor is invisible. It does not even connect directly to the Queen's Chamber. The connecting openings were broken out of the wall 120 years ago by Mr. W. Dixon. Through this model corridor, the soul of the pharaoh was intended to ascend to the stars. But unfortunately, no pharaoh was ever buried inside the small Queen's Chamber, and no soul could have flown to the stars. Even if a body had been laid to rest there, and if the shafts had been connecting, the pharaoh's soul still could not have escaped to the stars unhindered. After all, the Gottenbrink shaft is blocked by a rock, and according to Egyptologists, there is nothing behind that rock. Poor pharaoh. Stadelman's prosaic theory and his repeated admonition that no human being could have crawled through the narrow Gottenbrink shaft or used it to transport a sarcophagus or treasure is the epitome of nonsense. Let us take a different perspective. Let us assume that Caliph Abdullah al-Ma'mun, who managed to dig a tunnel into the pyramid in 827 AD, created a different opening into the pyramid from the one which we know today. He could have found an entrance on the 74th layer of bricks and discovered a chamber. From this chamber, a small square opening, 20 centimeters wide, one could have descended into the pyramid. Later, Egyptologists would call this chamber Mamun's chamber. They too would discover the square hole and would call it a soul corridor, a model corridor, or even an air shaft. Then one day, Rudolf Gottenbrink appears with a small caterpillar vehicle, which he guides 60 meters down the corridor. There, the robot's path is blocked by a rock. According to the expert's myopic view, the newly discovered shaft cannot be leading to a chamber because no human being could have crawled through the narrow shaft or used it to transport a sarcophagus or treasure. Excuse me, gentlemen. The fact is that the shaft, viewed from above, does lead into the Queen's chamber. What kind of senseless view proclaims that it couldn't be the other way around? No one with any kind of factual knowledge would ever presume that treasures or a sarcophagus were transported through a square tunnel with a width of 20 centimeters. The mysterious door in the Gottenbrink shaft may very well, but does not necessarily, conceal a chamber, which may have another entrance as well, just like the Queen's chamber. The Gottenbrink shaft may lead out of the Queen's chamber, or into it, depending on one's viewpoint. The Queen's chamber may also be reached through another independent entrance. The Gottenbrink shaft may lead into another chamber, even if the door or the stone blocking it is permanently sealed. After all, the two shafts extending from the Queen's chamber, the southern one being the Gottenbrink shaft, were also sealed until last century. If Mr. Dixon had not taken a pick to the walls, we would have no knowledge of either shaft, and no robot would have ever climbed the Gottenbrink shaft. In other words, if the robot had descended into the Gottenbrink shaft from the top, it would have been stopped in front of the Queen's chamber, just as it was stopped having started its journey from the bottom. The all-knowing experts would have agreed that this was the end, that there couldn't be anything behind the blocked passage. No one would have attempted to drill through the stone door or dissolve it with acids. And this is called science? What has happened to curiosity and the desire to explore the unknown? Instead, we are told categorically that there is nothing behind the door of the Gottenbrink shaft. And anyone who does not share this view is denounced as a lunatic with ridiculous fantasies. At the end of the shaft, Gottenbrink's robot filmed two metal brackets, which are attached directly to the door. It can hardly be argued that the brackets are made of metal, because fortunately, part of one piece broke off and is now lying on the ground. The only metal, if any, known in Khufu's times was copper. Consequently, the metal brackets are labeled matter-of-factly as copper brackets. But the copper could turn out to be something different entirely. Never fear, though, because Professor Stottleman and his brave band of high-caliber Egyptologists will be ready with a natural and sensible solution. In an interview with radio and TV journalist Torsten Sasse, Stottleman explained, "What the copper piece was for? Initially, we thought that the copper plates had a technical function. But judging from their extreme thinness, I would eliminate that as a possibility today, and would be more inclined to assume that they are hieroglyphics. Hieroglyphics that had been placed there for ornamental purposes. If they are indeed hieroglyphics, they would of course have a symbolic value as well. We must ask ourselves, what can they mean? An obvious answer would be a symbol such as the lotus blossom. The lotus blossom is the symbol of the south, the southern part of the country. That could be it. Or maybe even stronger, the symbol shoot in ancient Egyptian. It is a parasol of sorts which is carried behind the king in a festive procession. So it might be possible that these parasols were placed here so that the soul of the king could grab them on its way to heaven. Good heavens! I have pointed out earlier in this book that the Great Pyramid is a huge, largely anonymous work. No one ever mentioned a word about its construction, neither the designers and architects, nor the builders, priests, or pharaohs. There is not a single inscription that would indicate how it was done. No one left behind even the briefest note to answer any of our questions regarding its construction. The pyramid itself features no hieroglyphics at all. The walls are bare, unlike the walls of other ancient Egyptian tombs that are covered with symbols. It is said that Khufu, the alleged builder of the Great Pyramid, was a tyrant whose ambition it was to create the greatest monument of all time. Yet he and his servants forgot to praise the builder in the pyramid. Not a single symbol is dedicated to the memory of Pharaoh Khufu. No mention is made to any great deeds accomplished by this particular ruler. No god or goddess is being honored. No ancestors are being praised. Not a single prayer is inscribed in the ceiling. All the walls, corridors, and chambers of the Great Pyramid are smoothly polished. They never featured a single hieroglyphic, not even in the ancient past. The whole structure is perfectly anonymous. Oh, but wait a minute. The door at the end of the Gantenbrink shaft could feature the Shut hieroglyphics, so that the pharaoh can grab his parasol and join his forefathers without getting sunburned. It takes some imagination to think of that. Unfortunately, my imagination doesn't stretch that far. A small triangular piece is missing from the lower right-hand corner of the door in the Gantenbrink shaft. Next to it, the robot camera recorded a narrow band of black dust. Professor Stadelman interprets this dust as residue from the eroded metal brackets on the door of the model corridor. If we take at face value this expert interpretation, which claims that the Gantenbrink shaft is nothing but a model corridor sealed by a stone door, then the shaft should be completely sealed. Not a breeze should have disturbed the sealed vault. Moreover, the Gantenbrink shaft was completely sealed off until 100 years ago, and thus did not lead directly into the Queen's chamber. The left metal bracket on the door is partially broken. The black dust, however, is located in the right corner. Is this the work of dust fairies? If the two metal brackets had indeed rusted simultaneously and quietly for several thousand years, the black dust would have been found at the bottom of the door, directly below the brackets. That is not the case. It protrudes from the tiny triangle as if a very weak breeze had blown it through the opening. Even a very faint breeze would indicate a continuation of the Gantenbrink shaft on the other side of the door. Or maybe the presence of another chamber with a separate entrance. The 5-millimeter-wide laser beam emitted by the Upuout robot disappeared under the doorframe. No matter whether the stone is a door or a final wall, the fact is that it does not rest firmly on the ground. Shouldn't that give us something to think about? Evidently not, because the Egyptologists have decided once and for all that it is a model corridor. Additionally, more detailed studies are totally unnecessary. Dubious credibility. On August 5, 1993, the director of the Egyptian Museum in Berlin, Professor Dietrich Wildung, wrote in the Frankfurter Allgemeine newspaper, "Certainly Egyptologists should be grateful to Rudolf Gantenbrink, but he is unable to resist the lure of the publicity-generated boulevard press and naively stumbles into the quagmire of pyramid legends and mummy myths." Soon enough, Eric von Daniken enters the scenario, interpreting the dark dust at the bottom of the stone door as an indication that the mummy of King Khufu is buried behind the door. And where there is an untouched mummy of a pharaoh, one is sure to find the immense treasure which has sparked the imagination of people since the times of Herodotus. Automatically, the gears of hobby archaeologists start turning, and the cautious experts are denounced as being out of touch, unwilling to let go of the crusty old weight of their traditional teachings. This is the kind of ammunition Egyptologists use to fight their battles and to discredit those holding different views. It has never once occurred to me to interpret the black dust as an indication that the mummy of King Khufu is buried behind the door. This idea was proposed by David Keyes, an archaeological correspondent for the British newspaper The Independent. I would never suggest the presence of a pharaoh's tomb or an alleged gold treasure in the Great Pyramid, because I believe that Khufu had nothing to do with the building of the pyramid, which is generally attributed to him. I certainly don't expect to find his tomb there. What else could be concealed behind the door blocking the Gartenbrink shaft? Presumably the same thing that would be found in all other, as yet undiscovered chambers, various writings and documents, as we have been told by 14th century Arab historians. Information for the people of the future. Information which, incidentally, belongs to all of mankind. The pyramid does not have any ornamental hieroglyphics, because it did not belong to one particular pharaoh. It belongs to all of mankind. In his article in The Independent, David Keyes draws attention to another curious fact. The difference in elevation between the Queen's Chamber and the King's Chamber is 21.5 meters. The same elevation is found between the King's Chamber and the door at the end of the Gartenbrink shaft. Coincidence? Or evidence of another chamber? Professor Dietrich Wildung, who propagated those lies about me in the Frankfurter Allgemeine, is also the president of the International Association of Egyptologists. He stated in an interview with SFB Radio in Germany that Egyptologists don't harbor the illusion that their field, their knowledge, has to make everyone happy. He said that the vision of an all-pleasing, comprehensive archaeology for everyone is nonsense, completely out of tune with market realities. Since this is the prevalent opinion among the leaders of the Egyptologists' community, it is not surprising that they are not interested in public opinion at all. They already know for certain that there is nothing, absolutely nothing, to be found inside the Great Pyramid. Why should they bother listening to non-Egyptologists? Why does the public continue to finance this exclusive clan of elitist buddies? Like the kings they supposedly study, they never give any kind of accounting to their subjects. Now the experts from the German Archaeological Institute would like to examine the northern shaft extending from the Queen's Chamber. Rudolf Gartenbrink agrees with them. I am more inclined to ask, however, why we shouldn't first finish the homework that we have started. Various propositions and suggestions have been submitted for opening, drilling, or even dissolving the stone door. How come the opinion, cooperation, and technical expertise of Rudolf Gartenbrink are no longer desired? How can scientists, who are generally a reasonable and humorous bunch, react with such arrogance and envy? I have a feeling that there is more than envy involved here. The representatives of exalted Egyptology are insulted, wounded in their pride, because a non-archaeologist made an unexpected discovery. They are furious because Gartenbrink talked to the media. Do spoiled little children ever grow up? Or could it be that they are trying to hide what's behind the door? Maybe they are trying to avoid losing face and plan to examine in secrecy what the stone door has for thousands of years concealed. It is pointless to get angry. The fact is that the scientists in charge in Egypt do not want publicity, unless it is well-controlled publicity of their own creation. No journalists or neutral observers are to be present when the Gartenbrink shaft is explored and the mysterious door is opened or a hole drilled in it. There will be no TV cameras broadcasting pictures to the whole world or showing the walls of the shaft in every detail. Egyptologists do not want any experts from other sciences to validate the metal analysis of the door brackets. All this childish furtiveness supposedly is designed to allow Egyptologists to work in peace and quiet. I empathize with this notion. But this time we are not dealing with some insignificant tomb, but rather with the Great Pyramid, which has fascinated mankind for thousands of years. We are dealing with the most gigantic structure this planet has ever seen, one of the seven wonders of the world, a monument which has been the topic of legends and writings for thousands of years. Egyptology is missing out on a great opportunity to showcase its proper and scientifically flawless proceedings to the whole world. Here, Egyptologists have the chance to separate fact from fiction, once and for all, under the watchful eyes of all those lunatics and speculators who suspect mysteries and conspiracies at every turn. Could it be that they are afraid there might be something behind the Gutenberg shaft after all? Is this the real reason behind the Egyptologists' childish secretiveness? Earlier archaeologists were not that particular. Journalists were present at the opening of the tombs of Tutankhamun and Sekhemket. Nowadays they have media networks and live broadcasts which could transmit the images from Gutenberg's robot in the Great Pyramid simultaneously to homes and auditoriums worldwide. It would not be necessary for a horde of journalists to squeeze into the Queen's chamber. The experts would be left to do their job peacefully and conscientiously. But what we need are live pictures taken as the shaft is being explored, not pictures that are broadcast days, weeks, or months after the fact, neatly cut and accompanied by elaborate captions. Just imagine that the United States had kept secret a monumental event such as the first moon landing, and that several weeks later NASA released censored pictures to the public. Everyone would have been outraged, and with good reason. What are you trying to hide from us? Why aren't we being informed from the very beginning? Why should taxpayers support organizations which obviously don't respect them enough to tell the truth? The Egyptologists from the German Archaeological Institute and the Antiquities Service are afraid of publicity. Those who shun publicity and try to shroud their activities in secrecy usually have something to hide. There is no other way to look at it. Those who try to conceal things end up having to lie about them later. As long as Egyptologists choose to practice this kind of cloak-and-dagger routine, the public has no reason to believe anything they have to say. They may line up a whole procession of honest men who solemnly declare that, as expected, nothing was found behind the door of the Gutenberg shaft. The public, doubtful and critical, will not believe them. They have blown their chance. In ancient times, Cornelius Tacitus, a Roman historian, declared, "Those who are upset by criticism admit that they deserve it." This concludes The Eyes of the Sphinx. Tantor Audio is proud to present a bonus interview with author Eric von Daniken.
Eric von Daniken's first book, Chariots of the Gods, became a worldwide bestseller following its publication in 1968 and has been translated into 32 languages. Tantor Audio is very pleased to be releasing for the first time on audio four of Mr. von Daniken's books, Chariots of the Gods, Twilight of the Gods, The Eyes of the Sphinx, and History is Wrong. And we are very honored to have Mr. von Daniken with us today as our guest. Welcome, Mr. von Daniken.
Well, welcome myself. Happy to be with you on the phone.
Thank you so much. Now, of course, you are the Swiss author best known for your claims about extraterrestrial influences. And this is a topic that has really been popular since 1968, since your very first book, Chariots of the Gods. And of course, we've had movies and a television series, and there's a current series on History Channel now. about ancient aliens, and all of this can be attributed to your early work. And so I was wondering if you could tell the listeners, what was it, what were your earliest experiences, and at what age did you first have the feeling about these ancient aliens?
I was educated in Switzerland. I am Swiss. And I was educated for 6 years in a Swiss boarding school led by Jesuits. So I was a strict Catholic. And in my boarding school, we had also to learn Latin and Greek. And we had to make translations for some parts of the Old Testament of the Bible. Now, you have to understand, I was a very, very deep believer in God. By the way, I am still a deep believer in God. I'm one of these persons who still pray. But for me, as a young man, God had to have a few minimal qualities. For example, God would never make mistake. Or God would never use a vehicle to move from one point to the other because God is all over. We say he's omnipotent, etc. Now, by making translations from the Bible, especially from the book of the prophet Ezekiel, I had of a certain doubts in my own religious education, because the prophet Ezekiel describes, by the way, in the first person as an eyewitness, he describes a vehicle who descends from the sky. He describes the wheel of the vehicle, the wings of the vehicle. He describes the noise which the vehicle makes, etc. He calls all this the splendorness of God. Now, of course, as a young man, I asked my professors, what's this all about? And the professor said, well, Eric, you have to consider this as a vision. Ezekiel had a vision, but I could not believe in the vision because it was too natural, the explanation. So I simply wanted to know if other communities in antiquity also have similar stories like the ones we find in the Bible. And so I started to research. And finally, I came up with the hypothesis, or with the speculation, if you wish, that our ancestors must have seen some extraterrestrials long, long time ago. Now, at that time, our ancestors were Stone Age people. They could not understand what was going on. So they believed, of course, erroneously, they believed that these extraterrestrials were some kind of gods. We all know that there is only one God. But that was the misunderstanding in the past, and that's how it all started.
It's almost 50 years since the publication of your first book. Why is this still capturing the imagination of young people and older people?
Because so many things have changed in the past 50 years. You see, after Chariots of the Gods, I was, for example, attacked by some of the scientific community. They say this is all ridiculous, because no extraterrestrial, even if they would exist, they would never be able to visit us because there are distances with the speed of light and the next stars are far away, so they could never reach us. In the meantime, we see quite possibilities how interstellar space travel would be possible. Or I speculated at that time that some of these gods made some genetical experiments with our ancestors. Of course, I was ridiculed. In the meantime, we know that such genetical experiments are possible. Our genetics are doing it every day. And so on, the situation has changed completely. Also, I know, and we know, much more of the old texts today than we knew 50 years ago. So many new old texts have been found in ruins all over the world. And this is my speciality, to find it and if possible to translate it, and if I'm not able to translate it, so I hire some professors who make translations. You see, in the beginning, in the old texts, we always hear, for example, that some humans, some of our forefathers, were taken into the heaven. Now the word heaven, in the religious sense, means a place of happiness, a place where you are united with God, with the Lord, after death. In the meantime, we understand that the word heaven in ancient texts was not just a religious meaning. Heaven was also space. So space is not the same thing as heaven. You see, the sky is up there. Some of our ancestors were taken into the sky and were brought back.
You have over 24 books, and they've been translated into 20 or more languages. Can you tell us, are you working on any books currently?
Of course, I'm always working. You see, I have a very big archive, and in my archive, I have about 60,000 pictures, which I made over the last 50 years worldwide. And at the moment, I'm working on 5 volumes of a picture book. Every volume has just 200 pictures, so with 5 volumes, we will have altogether 1,000 pictures. I show the most incredible things in archaeology which exists around the world.
Before we end our conversation today, I think my son, who is a big fan of yours and of Ancient Aliens, would like me to ask you, what do you think is going to happen in 2012?
The Maya calendar has a starting date. And the starting date of the Maya calendar, if we translate it into our Christian calendar, is August 14th, 3114 BC. That was the starting point of the Maya calendar. Now, every normal calendar has no ending date. For example, in our Christian calendar, we can go on and count and count. We can say, now it's September 2014 or so on. Not in the Maya calendar. The Maya calendar has an ending date. And you can translate the ending date into our calendar. And out comes December 23rd, 2012. Then the Maya calendar ends. Now we have Maya writings, even in some stone pyramids, where they say, at that date, a god with the name Bolon Yokte, that's the name of one of these gods, Bolon Yokte will return to Earth. So that would mean that on December 23rd, 2012, some extraterrestrials would return to Earth. Fantastic. The only problem we have is the calculation of the calendar. The specialists in Maya language, Maya astronomy, have calculated the starting point, as I said before, to August 14, 3114 BC. If this translation into our calendar is wrong, then the end date, 2012, will be wrong too. So we have traditions of the Maya which says some of the gods will return, but I would never count on the date. They will return one day, but if this will be in December 2012 or later or maybe earlier, nobody knows.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.